Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's an enormous day for the Isle of Man because after 40 odd years, George Bellairs is back on sale. For years, he's only been available on the internet at secondhand bookshops and by collectors, but now you can actually go out and buy George Bellairs books, and you can buy George Bellairs Manx books, particularly important. So we're here to celebrate the life and the work of a man who came from Heywood in Lancashire, who retired to Colby and died here on the Isle of Man. Now, he was a man who had two careers, one wife and a dog called Goofy. He did. Big fan of dogs. His first career was in banking, at which he prospered and rose to the top. And important as it was, it's a second career that interests us. This literary career would see his short stories and newspaper articles published from the 1930s onwards, right to the end of the 1970s. And his 58 novels under the name George Bellairs, 12 of which are about the Isle of Man, were published between 1941 and 1980. But also, we're here to put Lisa Stansfield in her place. As things stand, Lisa Stansfield is the most famous person to have ever lived in Heywood in Lancashire. Only for a year before her family moved to the birthplace of the co-op, Rochdale. And as much as we love Lisa, it's time for Lisa to get around the world and move on. Because our subject this evening wrote about intrigue, subterfuge, betrayal, swindlers, liars, cheats, murder, lots of murder. More than 150 people met their maker via his imagination and his typewriter. I'm going to do some readings throughout the evening, and I'm just going to give you some short extracts from two of the books that are available at the back, published by British Library Crime Classics, Death of a Busybody and Murder of a Quack. And you'll get I'll do as many as I can this evening, time permitting. And this is from Death of a Busybody, published in 1942. And it gives you a feeling of Bellairs feeling for eccentric characters. Going right back to Ben Jonson, the Comedy of Humours. He was right in that school. Reverend Ethelred Claplady, that's his name, has found the body of Miss Tither, the local gossip. And the local police force has called in Inspector Littlejohn. And here he comes. I don't know whether we ought to have trailed you down here on the Hillary murder case, Littlejohn, said Oldfield, Inspector Oldfield, but our chief's a hustler. He's keen on most up-to-date methods. We've a number of local burglaries and the like on hand, and half the men are away on ARP courses and such. This case will probably be a hard nut to crack. I think you'll find it interesting. I'd just better outline it. Oldfield gave Littlejohn a resume of the crime, its nature and details of discovery. Now, Hillary Magner's one of two villagers, Hillary Parver's the other, stands side by side about 4 miles from here on the Leicester Road, or just off it. Actually, Hillary Parver's a small offshoot of Magner. About 100 years ago, two bachelor brothers at Hillary Hall quarrelled and the younger went off, built himself a place about a mile away, put up a church too and a few houses just to make a village of his own. The pair of them started a sort of a competition as to who'd build the most magnificent church, because the one left behind in Magner wasn't going to be outdone, and started renovating and adding to his own. The result was that they ruined themselves, left two derelict halls and two fine churches, with few to use them and no money to keep them up. There's one parson for the both now, a decent chap, he's called Claplady. The body of the victim was found at the bottom of the vicarage garden in Hillary Magner, and he produced the photographs that had taken the day before. Not pleasant to look at, is it? See, the body was found in the vicar's cesspool. My own view is that somebody thought it was a good place, you know, to put him in. It's cleaned out every 6 months, and of course that happened on the morning of the crime. In the normal course, nobody would open it up again for another half year. It's the latest type, disposes of its own rubbish. There wouldn't be much left of a body at the end of that. Unfortunately for whoever planned it, the old chap who was on the job of cleaning out the septic tank left halfway, went on strike as a protest against something the vicar said to him, closed the thing and adjourned to the local pub. Then he repented, probably because he'd not been paid, and returned to his work, only to find he'd had visitors with something a bit more gruesome in his absence. What about the victim, Oldfield? Who is Tither? Who is she? I was coming to that, yeah. She's an old maid who lives in Hillary Magna. It's about the biggest Paul Pry in the county. Nothing goes on that she doesn't know about, or rather didn't. She lived at Briar Cottage with a maid who's been in the family since Ethel and Martha Tither were children. Martha died a couple of years ago. Now, the peculiar thing about the victim is there was some method behind her peeping and prying. She was hot on the track of sin with a view to plucking brands for the burning. Very religious, anxious to save souls from destruction by converting them from their evil ways. She was a sort of female peeping Tom, but when she'd seen what she was after, she didn't sneak off satisfied. Oh, no. She was after the culprits with tracks and exercises. Didn't do her a bit of good, of course, only made enemies for her. She unearthed quite a lot of secrets and skeletons in closets, and people were either afraid of what she knew or hated her for knowing all that there was to know about them. As far as I can see, there's no hint of blackmail, but if she's keeping filing cabinets full of her cases, she was a dangerous woman. Many's the one who'd probably like to murder her. Inspector Oldfield opened a drawer of his desk and passed over a folder of papers on the case. There's the police surgeon's report on the post-mortem. You'll see, she was hit on the back of the head with a blunt instrument. Might have even been a stone, and then she was pitched into the cesspit. She wasn't quite dead when thrown in. The real cause of death was drowning. Drowning in 4 inches of drainage water, in which she was found face down. Can you beat it? What an abominable end, Oldfield. Yeah. I had a good talk with the vicar yesterday. She was hanging around at the bottom of the orchard about an hour before she was killed. He said he got up late at 10 o'clock or thereabouts, and he saw her earnestly conversing with a chap called Haxley, retired man, lives at Hillary. The vicar said she was very excited and thrusting papers, apparently tracts as usual, in his face. We found a bunch of them in a handbag, which was beside the body. Prepare to meet thy God, they said. Terribly appropriate, don't you think? That was from Death of a Busybody. The other two together, the dead shall be raised, and Murder of a Quack. Here's our hero at work. Here's the man who perpetrated all that murder and mayhem on the right. Looks evil, doesn't he, eh? Everybody said he had twinkling eyes. There is the man himself. George Bellairs, a.k.a. Harold Blundell. That was taken in 1961. Now, George Bellairs' Little John books are classic British detective fiction laced with comic hypocrisy. Inspector Little John of Scotland Yard collects the clues and draws inferences, and the humour is provided by a wonderful collection of eccentric, oddball, colourful and quaint characters. That tradition has got long legs, goes back to the 16th and 17th century works of Benjamin Johnson and George Chapman and their comedy of humours. It's a main plot underwritten by a range of characters, each of which exhibits traits which dominate their conduct and personality. Now, fair analogy, I think, I always think of it in this way, of one of those old-fashioned fairground carousels, you know, with the horses on it. The main plot is the engine in the middle, and the diverting, garish comic relief rotates around it. Everything in the middle, and then the comic characters around the outside. And it's a terrific author who can do that and pull it off without going into absurdity. And Bellairs does that. That tradition, by the way, is endured to date with TV situation comedies. You look at some of the best that have a really important meaning at the middle, but ludicrous characters around it. So there we had Bellairs' eccentric range of characters, like the one who we were just talking about there, the Reverend Ethelred Claplady in Death of a Busybody, drinks a lot of sherry and keeps bees. From those type of clergymen to multiple drunken physicians, tyrannical daughters-in-law, crotchety coroners, Bellairs is neither cold nor unfeeling in his treatment of his characters. And there's an overall sense of redemptive goodwill to Bellairs' books. You think it's difficult with so much murder happening, 3 or 4 murders per book sometimes, to have redemptive goodwill. And that's the key. There's murder, but there is very little explicit violence. A lot of murder. So, Harold Blundell was born in Heywood in Lancashire on the 19th of April 1902. And from 1913, he went here, Heywood Day Secondary School at the junction of Hindhill and Pine Street in Heywood. And it was here that he met someone who would influence the rest of his life. He was a Manxman, and his name was Philip Corlett. Philip Caesar Corlett, who was the assistant senior master of Heywood Secondary School, that would later become Heywood Grammar School. Now, Philip Corlett was Manx. Educated in Douglas, he attended Liverpool University, obtained a bachelor's degree of science in 1904, and a master's the year afterwards. Now, he was a big influence on Harold Blundell. He was his form master, and like the majority of Manx exiles, he never lost an opportunity to express his enthusiasm for and love for the Isle of Man. And this infusion of Manx inspiration never left Harold. Harold left Heywood Secondary School before the Great War was over. The school provided good qualifications, and he was successful in securing an entrant position with a branch of the Lancashire and Yorkshire Bank at 29 Market Place, Heywood, in 1917, the Lancashire and Yorkshire. He maintained a friendship with Philip Corlett. After leaving school, he used to visit his old form master at home. And on one occasion, he visited the Corletts on the island itself, and he met Philip's wife's much younger sister. Her name was Gladys Roberts. And after a courtship fragmented by her living on the Isle of Man and his work in Lancashire, in 1930, she became Mrs. Harold Blundell. And Philip Corlett, his old form master and inspirational teacher, became his brother-in-law. Philip Corlett retained his position at the school. He was there until he retired in July 1948. He retired from a lifetime of teaching from, by then, what was Heywood Grammar School. And in 1949, Philip Corlett died. There's the branch, 29 Market Place in Heywood. You can see it's Martin's Bank there, which we'll come to later. But that was where Harold, that was his first job at the Lancashire and Yorkshire. The Lancashire and Yorkshire Bank was taken over by the Bank of Liverpool and Martin's, which itself was a meeting of two banks, Martin's private bank in the south of England and the Bank of Liverpool. Now, the new entity resisted calling itself the Bank of Liverpool and Martin's and Lancashire and Yorkshire and opted for simplicity. It was Martin's Bank. In 1928, when they formed together, Martin's became a huge banking business with literally hundreds of branches, and against the grain, kept its head office in Liverpool at number 4 Water Street. Now, this building is still standing. It's not a bank anymore. It's a cathedral of a place. Number 4 Water Street, a lavish building, 8 floors above ground, 3 below. The banking hall inside a huge horseshoe was... It was a cathedral, and it had its own silver service restaurant for staff. That was the headquarters, and by now, Harold was in with Martin's Bank. After his marriage to Gladys in 1930, they travelled extensively across Europe, including visits to Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Belgium, Italy, and Harold's beloved Haute-Provence in the south of France. Harold was by now an ambitious, capable young banking executive within a flourishing banking business. He'd studied for and obtained a BSc in economics from the London School of Economics in 1928. And in 1933, he left the Heywood branch and was transferred to the old Lancashire and Yorkshire head office, which was by now Martin's City office in Manchester, which is in 43 Spring Gardens in Manchester. Which is, if you know Manchester, it's a wonderful thoroughfare with about 12 listed buildings. He then headed, 43 Spring Gardens. It's actually now an Indian restaurant. 43 Spring Gardens. Spent 5 years at 43 Spring Gardens before he headed south to the home of banking. He went to Lombard Street in London. 68 Lombard Street. Now, the Martin's City office, and again, whereas 43 Spring Gardens have been the headquarters of the Lancashire and Yorkshire, 68 Lombard Street had been the headquarters of Martin's Bank. So it was now known as the Martin's City office, which was just another name for a large city centre branch. And it was the largest outside the head office in Liverpool. 68 Lombard Street. Now, he'd be based here for 3 years with an attachment to newly opened branches in Surrey. He'd become a banking inspector, going around, as nowadays you call it due diligence, but of course in those days the nearest to due diligence and a credit record was the bank manager knowing you. So he would go around making sure that everything was as it should be, which gave the Bellairs books subsequently a watertight reputation for financial detail in crimes. So he knew if there was ever a banking crime happened in a Belair's novel, you knew exactly how it would work, and he knew how it would work. So he'd be based here for 3 years with an attachment to Croydon and Richmond and Reigate. It was also while he worked here that Inspector Thomas Littlejohn of Scotland Yard would first appear. He was working here when war was declared. He was 36 years of age, an able-bodied man, but able-bodied men between the age of 18 and 41 were to prepare themselves for military service. But Harold didn't see active service, not because of his banking role, which wasn't a reserved occupation, it was because he only had the sight of one eye. He volunteered for nighttime duties, could have become an auxiliary policeman, could have joined the ARP or the Home Guard, but he became a fire watcher. And in World War II, a fire watcher's role was to, once the air raid siren had sounded, was to monitor the effects of the bombing raid and attempt to mitigate any initial effects of incendiary bombs with, get this, a stirrup pump and a bucket of water or a bucket of sand. That was no health and safety then. But mainly it was a tedious job. When nothing happened, it was nights of bleary-eyed boredom and tin mugs of cocoa. But for Harold, it offered a chance to write, and he did. And out came Inspector Littlejohn. Because alongside his banking career, Harold had developed a hobby as a writer with a nom de plume, George Bellairs. He wrote many articles and short stories for the newspapers, magazines and periodicals, including the Manchester Guardian, or the Guardian as it is nowadays. He wrote about foreign travel, which of course he'd undertaken regularly with Gladys. He wrote about other people's jobs and places of work, and he wrote about cuisine. He had a fine palate and wrote about it a lot, which was uncommon in those days. Now, upon arriving in London, he looked for more notable outlets for his work. He'd written short stories that had been published in Manchester, and after arriving, he placed two short stories, The Red Flag and The Curé's Boot, in Penguin Books' Penguin Parade, which was a paperback issue of short stories and poems. And he was successful in that. He submitted his novels to agents for consideration. And in 1940, a literary agent wrote back expressing interest in his work and suggesting she may be able to place his novels with a publisher. This wasn't just any literary agent. It was Christina Foyle. Christina Agnes Lillian Foyle was the daughter of William Foyle, founder with his brother Gilbert of Foyle's, the self-styled world's greatest bookshop. She joined the business in 1928 at the age of 17 and never left until she died in 1999. Now, Miss Foyle, as she insisted on being called, generally preferred animals to people. Her many pets included tortoises, which could be seen illuminating her garden at night with candles attached to their backs. She just didn't want to lose the tortoises. For 70 years, she presided over Foyle's lunches, where authors met their readers, and she was a redoubtable correspondent. Yes, she once wrote to Hitler. When Hitler was burning books, newly installed in power, she wrote to him saying she thought it was a bad idea, and could she buy them? He wrote back politely and said no. Miss Foyle offered her services as agent to George Bellairs, assuring Harold Blundell of publishing deals with one of the many popular book clubs of the day, the Thriller Book Club. Also, she said, John Gifford, the publishers, would be interested. Bellairs and Blundell must have been thrilled. They were foiled. Christina Foyle's address was 125 Charing Cross Road. Foyle's bookshop was located between 119 and 125 Charing Cross Road. The publisher, John Gifford, was at nearby 119 Charing Cross Road, and the Thriller Book Club was to be found at 121 Charing Cross Road. Its president was W.A. Foyle. So in other words, all those businesses, the Thriller Book Club, John Gifford, were interlinked businesses. The same people with Chinese walls separating different roles. Foyle's had 10 postal book clubs, popular fiction, biography and memoir, Catholic, children's, travel, scientific, garden, romance, Western and thriller. Thousands of dedicated members buying monthly selections. Foyle's had a huge database of names and addresses of members, urging them to enroll a friend and receive a gift. With Christina's formidable personality, in the literary world, 10 book clubs, his own publishing house, and a whopper of a bookshop on Charing Cross Roads. Foils meant big business. We've noted you've been foiled. Christina Foyle never made shopping at Foyles easy. She was a determined woman, willful, pig-headed, some people said. Her system of filing in the bookshop wasn't under author or subject or even title. It was under publisher. You had to know which publisher had published whichever book, and then you could find them. She delighted in people walking around in circles for 2 hours and then just wandering out, not being able to. But she was, paradoxically, she was very careful with the money, but then some trade orders would just disappear without an invoice, and they just hope they get paid. That was Christina. And as for what you can see here, these are some of the authors that she cajoled into giving their rights for the Thriller Book Club. That's just a fraction, and that with 10 book clubs. In 1941, George Bellair's first novel, Little John and Lee, was published. And there followed three more in 1942, three more in 1943, two in 1944, and two in 1945. He couldn't stop that fire-watching habit. In 1944, though, he was back in the Northwest. He was away from Lombard Street and back in Rochdale as the manager of Martin's Bank in Rochdale. Now, one can only wonder at Harold Blundell's feelings at having left Haywood Branch 11 years previously, worked at Manchester City office, worked in Lombard Street in London, having travelled widely for those days, having created fictional characters and being a published author of 9 novels. And here he was back 4 miles from his birthplace. Well, I think he'd have been proud, justifiably proud of his labours. He was back as a manager of a branch. And his career was in the ascendancy. After 3 years as a manager of Rochdale, he was back at Spring Gardens in Manchester. He was then superintendent of all branches, more than an inspector. And in 1953, he became chief of the Manchester office, a post he held until retirement on the 30th of April 1962 at the age of 60. He left school aged 15. And was a keen advocate of adult education. Indeed, his LSE degree was done partly in Manchester. He'd lectured for the WEA, the Workers' Education Association in London, taught economics and modern European history in the extramural department of the University of Manchester. He was a member of the Presbury Dramatic Society, where he produced The Brontes of Howard Parsonage in 1948. Harold was a philanthropist, plus a member of the United Manchester Hospitals Board, chairman of the Private Patients Home and treasurer of the Northern Congregational College. In 1957, he was awarded an honorary master's degree by the University of Manchester for civic services and services as a writer. He'd had a stellar banking career. From a kid who went to Haywood Secondary School, he was the top of the tree in the northwest of England. He was very much loved. Those twinkling eyes, his smile. But Harold Blundell had an eye as sharp as a gimlet. Nothing ever got past him. He was, it's a cliche, but he was firm, but he was very, very fair. Now, it's said that Manx girls who marry off the island always manage to bring their husbands back. And so it went that when Harold retired, Gladys came home. Gladys Blundell fulfilled the formula. In 1962, they returned home from Macclesfield, by that time. And she and Harold started a new chapter in a bungalow they'd had built at the top of Glen Road in Colby. It's still there, and it's still in the family. And for the next 21 years, George Bellairs continued to write Little John novels, participated in Manx life. He was a popular speaker at local events. As was alluded to, he'd often be invited, and indeed in the UK he was invited to give lectures as a senior banker. He'd go to everywhere from Rotary to Women's Institute, and they'd start off hearing about banking, but the moment they found out he was a crime writer, he was George Bellairs, that was it. Banking went out of the window, and in came murder. He participated in Manx life. He was a speaker at events. He helped local charities, especially he was treasurer, chairman and president of the MSPCA. He wrote occasional articles for Manx Life magazine. He maintained contact with the local Martin's Bank colleagues. And like most of them, he probably, well, I would say he would have been dismayed, because all Martin's people were dismayed. In 1968, by special act of Parliament, the UK Parliament forced Martin's Bank and Barclays to merge. And only the Barclays name remained. So the Martin's Grasshopper and the Bank of Liverpool Liverbird went, and the Barclays Eagle was in charge. He was very friendly with the painter William Hoggart and his wife Dazine. He attended their Sunday literary salons and was a great admirer of Hoggart's paintings. He managed to include Hoggart's work in several books, and the Archdeacon Kinraid, who I'll come to, had a Hoggart in the Grenaby Parsonage. In 1954, he dedicated the Cursingstones murder to William and Dazine. Harold would have been sad at Hoggart's death in 1961, just a year before he retired to the island. Now, Belair's book steered away from the golden age trait of the gentleman detective. There are no toffs, there are no titled sleuths racing around in sporty Alvises, no drawing room denouement. Belair's had no time for sanctimony or greed. The role of ordinary people in crime seemed to intrigue him, and eventually would lead Little John to the killer. And I think this leads us directly to Harold Blundell. He was a lad from Haywood who had risen to those upper echelons of banking, but he never forgot the connection between those at the top and those at the bottom, and the fundamental human interdependence that unites them. Now, I want to take a quick look at some of Belair's recurring characters, the ones I'm sure you'll be extremely familiar with by the time you bought the books at the back. I think they're $8.99, I think. They're very good. British Library, Vintage Crime Series, two of them. Actually, in one of them, you get two for one. And the Ipso books, the two Ipso books are Manx books. Toll the Bell for Murder and The Night They Killed Joss Varan are both Manx books, if you're looking for Manx books. Here's Scotland Yard. Inspector Thomas Littlejohn started his career in Manchester as what they used to call a flatty, someone with flat feet. He was on the beat. His methodical approach led him to Manchester CID, and he became a detective sergeant. His systematic, orderly technique saw him rise upwards and obtain a transfer to Scotland Yard. Now, it was in London that he met Letty Uprichard, who became Letty Littlejohn, with whom he set up home in a top-floor mansion flat in Hampstead. So was Little John Belair's alter ego? The inspector stood 6 foot tall, and for the times he was heavily built at 16 stone. Sported a moustache and he smoked a pipe. Everybody smoked a pipe in those days. Tom Littlejohn had no special tricks, no powerful friends, never pulled a rabbit out of a hat. Belair's always refers to his twinkling eyes. That's the whole alter ego bit. Littlejohn moves easily through that very stratified society of the day. And he treats servants, sailors, labourers in the same way that he treats titled aristocrats and professionals. He dislikes pomposity, affectation, snobbery, and above all, he can't bear bullies. He displays a firm sense of moral values, but has no patience with extreme religious sects or Bible thumpers, as he calls them. Belair's books often have an ecclesiastical theme, where the local vicar, priest, or pastor is consulted for information. And of course, the Manx archdeacon looms large in the Manx books. Belair's sidekick is Sergeant Robert Cromwell, his right-hand man. Sergeant Cromwell is described, he's one of my favourites, Bob Cromwell. He's described as lean and melancholy. Now, this is the 1940s we're talking about, right? He's very particular about his physical body, undertaking a programme of physical jerks every morning and deep breathing, gargling and teeth cleaning every evening. An abstemious character, Bob Cromwell doesn't believe in hot baths, judging that they sap the vitality and wash away the insulation of the skin, letting out the energy. On this account, Bob Cromwell prefers cold baths. He always wore a sober dark suit and coat, white wing collar and a bowler hat. You wouldn't miss him, would you? And he did yoga back in the 40s. Belair's was, he tuned into all sorts of things. Bob Cromwell, you often hear they're in adjoining hotel rooms when they're in some country village somewhere sorting out a murder. And Little John would hear Cromwell wheezing away first thing in the morning, doing physical jerks and deep breaths. Bob Cromwell was single up to 1942 when in Murder of a Quack, which you can find at the back, published by British Library Vintage Crime Series. It's at the back there. It's very good value. He marries the widowed landlady of a hotel who joins him in Shepherd's Bush, where they have a daughter named Jane Elizabeth, whose godfather is, of course, Tom Littlejohn. Bob Cromwell's utterly dependable, completely loyal to Littlejohn, whom he clearly admires. Now, here he is, Archdeacon Caesar Kinraid. Eagle-eyed Manx people will know that isn't Archdeacon Caesar Kinraid. Who is it? Archdeacon Cewley. But Archdeacon Caesar Kinraid was Bellairs paying homage to Philip Corlett, Harold Blundell's teacher back in Heywood. Corlett would have been well aware of Archdeacon Cewley. His appearance and presence. In the books, he's described as having a shovel hat, gaiters, and a froth of white beard. There he is. John Cewley was Archdeacon of Man from 1912 to 1938, previously was a fixture in the South, having been Vicar of Kirkarbury, then Rural Dean of Castletown. Archdeacon Caesar Kinraid is an example of the eccentric characters Bellairs was fond of, but would never take to absurdity. He could use characters' traits to make a point, but retain their humanity. Kinraid also served a purpose as being the source of all things Manx, and Bellairs was, I think it's fair to say, was passionate about the Isle of Man. In the 1950s, he was a widely read author, but he wrote a lot about the Isle of Man with a verisimilitude, a truth that wasn't around at the time. And he used Kinraid as a method to get Manx things over, which I'll show you an example of that in a while. You see, he was the source of all things Manx, and being a clergyman was able to cross social boundaries. He speaks, understands Manx Gaelic, which at the time, in the 1940s and 50s, wasn't considered by the majority of Manx to be a passport to progress. Quite the opposite in some places. Kinraid is educated, erudite, and because of his position, can provide an entree to the closed worlds of farming and fishing, still are. Archdeacon Cewley died in 1941, aged 81. Interestingly, Archdeacon Kinraid had no such earthly quandary. For a bank manager, Bellairs played games with Archdeacon Kinraid's age. In Half Mass for the Deemster in 1953, Kinraid was described as 83 next birthday. In the previous book, Death in Dark Glasses from 1952, he was 84. In 1962's Death of a Tin God, he joined Littlejohn in an investigation in France, presumably at the age of 92. And he was still there in the book at the back, The Night They Killed Joss Varin, published in 1970. He would have been 100. Artistic license. Another constant in Bellairs Manx books is Grenaby. The Archdeacon's home is in Grenaby, and Littlejohn stays at the parsonage when he's on the island. Its peace and serenity are highlighted as the backdrop to the almost father-son relationship of the clergyman and the man from Scotland Yard. Their chats, usually over a pipe smoke after a gorgeous meal prepared by the formidable housekeeper, Maggie Keggan. They thought the world of Maggie and she did of them. The Littlejohn books were set in a different world. It was a momentous period for Britain, embracing, in the 1940s, Dunkirk, the Battle of Britain, D-Day, victory, austerity, the founding of the welfare state. Now, although these events form no part of the narrative of the stories, their effect can be perceived as the formidable inspector works his way through case after case within the civilian world. It was a much physically grubbier world. I often think if we could go back in a time machine, the thing that would strike us is that it was dirtier than it is nowadays. Everybody's obsessed with cleanliness now. It was a lot smokier. It would have been a lot smellier. I'm sure you may remember those adverts, even in the 1960s, for Lifebuoy soap. B.O. It would have been smellier in those days. And it was much more stratified socially, much more than today. People knew where they fitted into society, and everything changed after the Second World War and continues to change, which is a good thing. But even though it was a grubbier, smokier, smellier, and much more stratified socially world than it is today, Belair's world is one inhabited by genuine characters and unadulterated humanity, and that's why even today these books ring so true. Sometimes the world today can seem a little grey, a little overregulated, a little vanilla, with a quality of individuality only filtering in from outside influences and perhaps media stereotypes. Belair's will show you humankind, and I commend those works to you. In 1955, you can see some of the impact he made. This is Hatchard's in Piccadilly in London, and the window that was given over to George Belair's, Harold Blundell, the lad from Haywood, the lad who would go to the Isle of Man. Hatchard's, if you know it, in fact, I'll show you now. There's Hatchard's now. Well, actually not now, it was April of this year. That's in, I'm stood in the middle of the road, nearly got knocked over. And that is the very window that the Belair's display was at. So he was a successful author. He didn't make an awful lot of money, I think, for two reasons. One, Christina Foyle was very cautious with the purse strings. She knew how to make money for Foyles, and she never paid an author a penny more than she thought he deserved or could pay attention to. Harold Blundell had a very successful banking career. He didn't need the money. He'd been travelling widely in Europe before. He and Gladys had no children, so he didn't really write for money. And it was only years later when a man who was a critic, Francis Iles, who was known as Anthony Barclay, the writer, saw some of George Belair's contracts with Foyles and said, "You're mad. This woman is taking you to the cleaners and you're a banker." But Harold didn't seem to mind. Christina Foyle had taken a chance on him in 1940, and he stayed with her. He stayed with Foyles for the rest of his life. Another thing notable, you'll see examples around the library, is the cover art. Absolutely wonderful cover art that set these Thriller Book Club books apart and made them leap off the catalogue. So when people wanted them, I'll give you a bit from Cursing Stones, I think. Cursing Stones concerns a scallop dredger dredging off the Isle of Man. The Manx Shearwater dragged up the body of Cedric Levis, a philanderer with an unsavoury reputation. Chief Inspector Littlejohn of Scotland Yard, invited by his old friend Archdeacon Kinraid to spend a holiday on the island with him to investigate unofficially the occurrences at Cursing Stones, this was. And this is the one that's dedicated in 1954. Cursing Stones, dedicated to William Hoggett, R.I., and his wife, Dazin, in gratitude for their friendship and genius. They lived at the Darrock in Port Erin. And Blundell used to visit, Blundell and Gladys used to visit. Joe Henn, the parson's neighbour, was making his way up the path. He wore old clothes and no collar, just a necktie around his scraggy throat and a bright brass stud shining in the neckband of his shirt, an old cloth cap on his head. On the way, he kept pausing to look at this and that in the garden, and Little John met him at the door. "Hello, Mr. Henn. Kinastashu!" 1954. Kinastashu, as we say in Manx. That means, "How do you do?" Mr. Henn, who'd come from Lancashire long ago, but pretended to those who didn't know it he was a native. "Come over, you see." "You and your own inspector?" "No, Mr. Henn. Inspector Perrick's here with me. Come in, won't you?" "No, not if you're busy. It'll do another time." "Treadalure, plenty of time, as we say in Manx. If Inspector Perrick's with you, it's all right, you're safe. But I think I ought to tell you there's been prowlers around here. It's up to no good. Ask Perrick, he'll know. There's not much the police don't know." "Come in, then, we'll talk at Perrick." "No, I'm not fond of the police myself, and his except in present company. I've had one or two quarrels with him." Joe Henn turned and made his way off, and made off the way he'd come. "Have I seen you, Inspector? I'll call again. You must come across and see me garden too, and the hut I built." "Yeah, so long then, so long, Mr. Henn." Now, Little John scratched his head. Joe Henn was getting more and more eccentric. Usually he couldn't get rid of him. Now he was anxious to be off. Prowlers? Little John remembered the reputation in Grenaby, the reputation it had for strange goings on, still has. Ghostly prowlers, in fact. There are at least half a dozen regular haunters accredited to Grenaby. Jimmy Squarefoot, a sort of man with a pig's head, the poor moor, as the natives called him, and a satyr called the Fanodery, who haunted the bushes, to say nothing of the water horse, the Cabalustia, who appeared in the river now and then, and the Began, the evil one, and the nightman, the Dunya E, who called to foretell disaster, prowlers indeed, the place was alive with them. What's he after? Perrick looked in the doorway of the dining room, watching Little John intently. Hen says there are prowlers around, you know all about it. What does he mean? Oh, Hen's got a bee in his bonnet. The lads keep coming and going and ravaging in his garden, and he thinks we ought to have a constable permanently there. An all-round year watch. He never eats the fruit he grows. He can't do it. There's too much of it. It does him no harm to have some of it pinched. Although it's immoral for a policeman to give vent to such sentiments, half of it rots anyway. The kids might as well take it. Is that all he wanted? It seemed to be all. He was embarrassed when he heard you were here. I'm not surprised. I was the one who interviewed him last night when he came to complain in Douglas. We had a right ding-dong. So in 1954, Bellairs, unashamedly putting Manx in, Manx folklore. He was very proud of the Isle of Man. That's from the Cursing Stones. And Death Treads Softly is about a man who subsequently was murdered, but was found in London and seemed to have lost his memory. This is right from the beginning. Saturday, and let me see, this is 1956 for Death Treads Softly. Saturday, November 6th, the King Ori, Liverpool to Douglas, Isle of Man, ploughed her way through seas, the colour of lead under heavy skies. It was a slight swell, otherwise the crossing was easy. 24 hours of endless rain. The downpour had started at noon the previous day when Little John had first met Finlow Crennel, his travelling companion, and he was still at it. Now they were eating their lunch in the dining saloon. No pleasure on deck, a meal helped pass the time away. Chief Inspector Littlejohn looked up from his plate at the man opposite. Before midday yesterday, he'd never set eyes on him. Another one of those strangers who suddenly drifted into his life and then, after a few hours or maybe days, vanished into the crowd and were never seen again. The man seemed to sense the Chief Inspector's scrutiny, met his gaze and smiled broadly. 24 hours of that smile that wouldn't come off. They'd even occupied the same room in Liverpool Hotel the night before, and Crennel had smiled in his sleep. A little robust, powerful man with a rolling gait, who'd once been at sea and then had settled down as a harbour master in the small port of Castletown, till he'd retired a year ago. Now he wore a ready-made dark grey suit, which fitted where it touched and looked as if he'd slept in it for a week. A soft collar with a red tie around his bull neck and a cloth cap on, which he was now sitting on because he hadn't known what to do with it when he entered the room. Finlow Crennel, age 66, born Ballabeg Arbury, Isle of Man. Height 5'8.5", eyes blue, bald, portly. That was how the description had run, and the accompanying photograph, an enlarged section of a crowd at some yacht races, had shown a round, smooth face, a short little nose, and a head shaped like an orange. Missing since October 28th. Superintendent Jenks had sent for Little John, and he'd found him in his office with Finlow Crennel sitting beside him, eating ham sandwiches and drinking tea from the canteen. I wonder if you can do any good with this chap, Little John. Crennel had looked up very happily, munching his bread and ham, and had given the inspector his now famous perpetual smile. He was found wandering around Limehouse last night. He'd been robbed of his pocketbook, if he ever had one. He wore a torn and dirty suit of sailor clothes and a cap with a Dublin maker's name. No means of identification at all. The unknown man looked at the new badly fitting suit that he'd been given and smiled with pleasure at it. He's lost his memory. There's a nasty mark on top of his head, and the surgeon says it's recent, not too recent. He doesn't know who he is, doesn't remember a thing, and he seems damn pleased about it too. The man nodded at him and gave that smile that just wouldn't come off. It's getting on my nerves, Little John. We've been at him on and off for hours. The missing persons files haven't come in yet. We contacted them. Seems to have come off some ship or another. All we know is that when he says anything, it's all small talk. He says he's hungry and such like. He speaks with a kind of brogue. Nobody seems to understand it. It isn't Irish. It isn't Scots. It isn't Welsh. And now, well, here's where you might help, Little John. Is it Manx? You've been to the Isle of Man a lot. See what you can do. Him and his smile and his lost memory is getting me down. Little John looked the man over. The orange-shaped head, totally bald except for a thin thatch of grey down, the innocent blue eyes, and, of course, the smile. How are you getting along? Oh, middling! Little John smiled back. Kinestashu, he said. The blue eyes met Little John's and the smile broadened. Prow, prow, replied the stranger. What did he say? Jenks eyed Little John with suspicion, and the chief inspector didn't tell him that he just uttered the only words of Manx he knew. I asked him how he was, and he says he's fine. He's Manx, all right. Death tread softly. Here's the one that was our poster. Corpse at the Carnival. It was also issued in Penguin as a paperback, and like many of his books, was translated into French, Spanish, Italian, and German. La mort d'oncle Fred, the death of Uncle Fred, was the French version of it. Corpse at the Carnival, this is. You can see the artwork has got the Villa Marina at the back. And there's Uncle Fred having copped it with the Manx. They always said, by the way, there were three elements to the artwork for the Thriller Book Club. There'd always be the principal artwork, the secondary artwork, and a background. So you can see Fred dead, the waitress finding him with the cat, and the procession along the promenade at the back. It's holiday time in Douglas, and a carnival crowd engulfs a solitary elderly man who's peacefully gazing out to sea. When the procession passes, the old man quietly dies. He's found to have a knife wound in the back. He's at first merely an anonymous victim. He's known casually by a few locals as Uncle Fred. Superintendent Little John calls to visit his old friend, the Reverend Caesar Kinraid, Archdeacon of Man. On his way home from a police conference in Dublin, he's asked by his comrade, Inspector Nell, of the Manx CID, to give him a hand in the case. As the inquiry progresses, Uncle Fred is brought to life, virtually, by Little John. The lost years of his past are found again. His friends and his foes show up. Here's another example of how Bellairs brings the characters to life. This is the boarding house that Uncle Fred lived in year-round. Little John and the Archdeacon are at the boarding house where Uncle Fred had lived. Little John caught the Archdeacon's eye, which was twinkling again. They both seemed to be imagining the same thing. 16 people plus Trimble and his three women, all in the sea vista, packed like sardines, breathing, fighting, scheming for bathrooms, scrambling for food, joking, frisking, quarrelling, lamenting, gossiping, slandering, and then packing up and off, leaving their litter and the ghosts behind to haunt the empty winter house when the season was over. Only Uncle Fred stayed on with the Trimbles. They went downstairs again. The musician was still playing the lament about the bluegrass country. It was top of the hit that season. Everybody was whistling or humming it. Dance bands were playing it. A guitar accompaniment from a recent film. The air had been ringing in Uncle Fred's ears as he died. As they passed number three, a head was thrust out. A honeymooner. A man in his mid-40s with a cunning, sallow face, big ears and thick lips and thin greying hair plastered back from his narrow forehead. He wore heavy, horn-rimmed glasses. "Sorry, Mr. Trimble, I just wanted to see you. It'll do when you're not engaged." The door closed gently. "Oh, as I thought, he's going to say they're off and they're trying to get away without paying for the whole time they booked. Some hope." Down below, an argument was going on, a man's rough voice and then a woman's. "No need to spoil everybody's pleasure just because the old chap's dead. We all come to it. Don't you argue with me. I've said he's not staying for dinner and I meant it. We've had enough of your family to look after without you bringing in strangers as well." Trimble could get down hardly quick enough. Here, what's all this?" A tallish, swarthy, pudding-faced man, half drunk already with another who looked like a pal, smiling awkwardly and trying to persuade his friend to let it drop and take him away. The woman was annoyed, and her anger enhanced her good looks. She was tall, plump and blonde and had all the poise and sophistication of a superannuated actress. She was between 40 and 50, looked after herself well, and was dressed in a skirt and jumper of a daring cut which showed her fine arms and as much of her bosom as decency would allow, and perhaps a bit more. Her antagonist was Greenhalge, father of the children, and he was wanting his friend to stay for lunch. The woman was winning hands down. Greenhouse couldn't keep his eyes off her arms, a figure in the centre of gravity where her jumper ended and the white flesh began. It put him quite out of countenance. All right, then, all right, but it's this poor sort of treatment for a holiday, Mrs. Trimble. Ah, so this was Trimble's mistress, Trimble's missus. Little John instinctively looked at two framed old portraits, one above the other, to the right of a cluttered-up bamboo hall stand. One showed Mrs. Trimble in tights, presumably as the principal boy in a pantomime, and the other, Trimble himself. Handsome, then in tights as well, standing at the foot of a trapeze. He'd been an acrobat. It was all there in black and white. The handsome acrobat and the principal boy, retired and in the boarding house business. Perhaps at first prosperous through taking in stage friends and followers, Trimble was hoping for an easy life where his wife did all the work. Instead, she turned the tables. He did the work, she managed the place, and strolled along the promenade when the fit took her. He'd gone to seed, and she kept up appearances in spite of it. Now she despised him. It was obvious from the way she looked at him and when he descended on the quarrel. She ignored him until she settled Greenhalge. And then, what about the dinner? What do you think you're doing? Well, the police called again. It's the superintendent. Is the parson the police as well? Then she caught the archdeacon's eye. Oh, I'm sorry, don't mind me. I'm just in a bad mood. High season, we got a lodger murdered. Everything's upset. And that Greenchild chap wants to bring a half-drunken friend of his in for dinner. I won't have it. We've got enough on as it is. There's the scene. And it's what he excelled at. I've just got a bit of time. I'll just give you a little bit of the Deemster, because it shows how Kinraid explained. And it shows how something's never changed. Half-mast for the Deemster was 50s. Any sign of land yet? Little man in a cloth cap and an overcoat several sizes too large for him regarded Little John with pathetic dog-like eyes. His complexion was pale green, and he'd only roused from his stupor in the hope of receiving some good news. I can't see anything. Little John wasn't feeling good himself. He'd done a fair amount of sea travelling in his time, several trips to the continent for holidays or to see officials at the Sûreté in France. Once he'd been over to New York to consult the FBI, but never anything like this. People said that on certain days you could see the Isle of Man from the mainland. Now it seemed the other end of the earth. This little man, with his coat sleeves over his knuckles, made retching noises, hurried to the rail of the ship, was met by a large wave and retreated soaked to the skin. He didn't seem to mind. If I could reach land, I'd never go to sea again. Archdeacon Caesar Kinraid, vicar of Grenaby in the Isle of Man, was the cause of it all. A friend of mine would like to have a talk with you, he'd written, and besides, if you don't pay me the promised visit before long, I'll be too old to show you my beloved island. You know I'm 83 next birthday. 83. Mrs. Little John wasn't with him. Her sister, who had a canon of the church for a husband and eight children, was moving again, this time to Comstock in the Fen, and there was a vicarage and 11 bedrooms. With her ninth on the way and domestic help hard to get, the canon's wife had sent the usual SOS to Hampstead. It was the middle of September and the weather on the mainland had been fine and bright. It had continued so across the channel, just long enough for an excellent lunch to be served. Thereupon the Mona had started to roll, and then pitch, and then do both. Some of the passengers prepared to disappear down below. Those who had been singing to the accompaniment of Sid Simmons and his 10 hot dogs packed up and had grown silent. Some lay on the floor and groaned. Others were strewn across all the place. The timbers rolled under Little John's feet. A blast of hot roast beef and cabbage rose from the dining room and swept the deck. Little John struggled up to the top deck and looked out over the heaving water and the leaden sky. You ought to cross by a boat, his wife had said. It'll blow the cobwebs away. As he stood miserably peering ahead, the prospect slowly began to change. It was like the transformation scene at a pantomime, when the electricians, by juggling with the light, suddenly convert the devil's kitchen into the home of the fairy queen. The Mona was tossing in tortured gloom, but ahead the sun was shining on calm water. The sky was turning to blue, and like a backcloth slowly illuminated by unseen floodlights, the Isle of Man, with gentle green hills sweeping down to the sea, was stretched out before them. The man in the big overcoat was at his elbow. He tapped Little John's arm gaily. His complexion had changed to a rosy pink, and the brandy he'd absorbed had rose abundantly on his breath. "What did I tell you?" he said, as though he'd been a prophet of salvation all the way. "What did I tell you? There she is!" He flapped his sleeve at the island like a conjurer who's performed a difficult trick. Having then justified, he made off to the bar to celebrate. People were surging on deck, smiling and congratulating one another, as though the end of the world had somehow been deferred. As if to cheer them up still more, the Mona slid into calm water and blew a wild blast on a siren to those ashore, like a badly frightened cock which crows when danger's past. The echo from Douglas Head threw back the sound. The man in the overcoat was back. "What about a little drink?" he said to Little John. "Half mass for the Deemster." Oh, well, let me just give you the bit about Kinraid in that. They're walking on the coast road towards Kroger. They strolled in an eminence in the road and the old man pointed to the direction of the sea. "There, did you ever see the likes of it? Difficult to believe that the ocean that had ever been so rough for now stretched like a sheet of green glass as far as you could see. Between the road and the sea, undulating fields divided by sod hedges and gorse flaming on top of them with clean white farmsteads dotted about them. Beyond, a long spit of land like a granite spur jutted out with a ruined chapel and the fort on one side and a lighthouse on the other. And in the middle of the base of the triangle of rock, the towers of King William's College in the old island capital of Castletown rose strong and grey. Parson Kinraid fished in the tails of his coat and brought out an old pipe, which he filled with a pewter from a pewter tobacco box after telling Little John to help himself. They leaned on their elbows against the wall and smoked, and Looney, his driver, who'd drawn up beside them, knew better than to disturb them. "We've got to call at Castletown," said the Archdeacon at length. "The court's sitting there today, and I've promised that we'll pick up the Deemster when it's finished. You know what a Deemster is?" "The judge, isn't it?" "More than that, Little John. It's a very ancient office, very ancient, and stands in eminence next to that of the governor of the island itself. In this small place, the Deemster is all His Majesty's mainland judges rolled into one. Civil, criminal, county court, quarter sessions, all rolled into one. Judge of appeal, too, against the decisions of his colleague, the other Deemster, when he sits with a judge from across the water to help him. Busy man?" "That's right, yeah. And before the laws were written or decisions recorded, he'd remember the law. Breast law, it was known then, as if cherished in the heart. They only take civil cases in Castletown today. First Deemster Quantrell's sitting today. I'm calling to bring him with us for dinner at Grenaby. He wants to meet you. He's in trouble. Somebody's tried twice to murder him. The Deemster." And you can see where Bellairs uses Kinraid to explain Manxness to people. And at that time in the 1950s, at the time of people like Doug Farragher, Mark Braid, and Ned Madrill, talking about Manx just wasn't done. And that was in popular culture. That was in Foyle's Thriller Book Club. Bellairs was an advocate of Manx culture and the Manx language. And he put it in 11, 12 books. Before I'm just about finished now. Before I conclude, I want to thank some people for this. I want to thank Trudy Cooper and Roy Peterson, who've allowed me to quote from some of their studies on Bellairs. John Quirk from Manx Litfest for programming the event. I want to thank Camilla Shesterpole from Peters Fraser and Dunlop, who does all the hard work in Drury Lane. I'd like to thank Lisa Stansfield. I think we've finished Lisa off, don't you? Whenever you think of Haywood in Lancashire, and I want you to tell all your Lancashire friends, Haywood in Lancashire, the home of Colby's novelist. I think George Bellairs would have enjoyed the happy coincidence, by the way, that brings us to within 50 yards of one of Harold Blundell's spiritual homes, his beloved bank, Martin's Bank, for years and years and years. Anybody, who's from Onchan? Hands in, right. Not a bad start. At the junction of Royal Avenue and Main Road is Royal Buildings, you know, next to those posh flats. Yeah. On the corner, it's the home of Vanity House. Yeah. You know Vanity House? Yeah. I'm assured it's the island's first dedicated HD brows, CND shellac and LVL lashes retreat. Yeah? Onchan residents who can remember that far back will know it used to be a branch of Barclays Bank. And before 1969, before the enforced merging of Barclays and Martin's, it was a branch of Martin's Bank. So it is no longer Vanity House, as far as I'm concerned. Every time I go and have my nails done at Vanity House, I'll refer to it as Martin's Bank. I think Harold would have approved, don't you? He would have walked out of this door with twinkling eyes. So I hope you found the background to Harold Blundell and George Bellairs illuminating, from humble beginnings in Haywood in Lancashire to comfortable retirement in Glenroad in Colby via a very prominent role in banking in the Northwest. A first-class storyteller. 5 dozen novels to his name. Read all over the world. The English-speaking world translated into Spanish, Italian and German. There's Muerte della Noche Tenebrosa, Death in the Fearful Night. Morte in Provenza, for Italian speakers. All over the world. Little known and out of print since 1980. But today, back on sale to a new readership. 'Twinkling Eyes is back. Welcome back to Harold Blundell. George Bellairs, thank you.